From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In 1747, composer Johann Sebastian Bach, late in his life and deeply rooted in a waning age of myth and mysticism, of faith and inspired belief, accepted an invitation from the young, ambitious warrior king, Frederick the Great of Prussia. That invitation produced a fateful meeting where old Bach met young Frederick, son of the Enlightenment, a powerful monarch tuned in to empiricism and reason. Frederick the Great presented Bach with a musical challenge. In the telling of our guest tonight, James R. Gaines, their meeting and that challenge played out as a clash of ages, of fundamental worldviews and understandings of life that still rages on. Tonight on Point, when ages collide, the epic encounter between Bach and Frederick the Great, between faith and reason. Joining me now from Paris is James R. Gaines, former managing editor of Time, People, and Life magazines. His earlier books include Wit's End, Days and Nights of the Algonquin Round Table, and The Lives of the Piano. His new book is Evening in the Palace of Reason, Bach Meets Frederick the Great in the Age of Enlightenment. James R. Gaines, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
A terrific book, and what a window on a moment in history that I had never stared at. You've brought it to life in a wonderful way. What drew you to the story of this encounter, James Gaines?
Well, I've always played Bach, and I've always loved Bach. And the chance to write about him was a chance to come to grips, I think, and this is in retrospect more than before the fact, was a chance for me to come to grips with... Well, I'm not a churchgoer, but there's something in the music of Bach that I find deeply moving in a spiritual kind of way. So I think it was an attempt for me to find out what was it in the music of Bach that does that.
It's a terrific story, and one that contrasts these ages, age of enlightenment, age of belief, age of faith, age of reason, in a way that I found resonates very vividly with so many of today's conversations. But you take us back to 1747 to look into that encounter. I wish you'd begin to set the table for us. Of the ages that were meeting, the sort of tectonic plate movements in the way humans, Europeans anyway, saw the cosmos at that time, what's the giant context of this meeting?
Well, it was really where the debate that goes on today began, because it was the beginning of the Enlightenment, which was the first time that people really thought there was a chance that by reason and empirical experiment, we could actually discover everything about the world. We could cure all the diseases. We could answer all the questions. There would be no mysteries left once we had exercised our reason to the ultimate extent. And we just kept honest about that. The corollary to that was that religion was considered superstitious and nonsense, and the people who believed in it credulous. It was a huge, huge confrontation.
The age that came before, often called the age of belief, even though it had the Renaissance and so much ferment in it, but it was the age represented in your telling of this encounter by Johann Sebastian Bach.
Yeah, and the Renaissance differs from the age of enlightenment in many ways, actually, but there wasn't the optimism in the Renaissance that scientific experiment could get to the bottom of everything. And there wasn't quite the hubris in the Renaissance that would disavow all forms of religion.
We look back now, and these great movements, these great ages, can seem relatively clear and sharply defined. How sharply defined was this clash of visions, of perspectives, at that time in the 18th century?
It was very stark. And Bach experienced it firsthand in his job in Leipzig with an Enlightenment rector with whom he had all sorts of problems. But it boiled down to the fact that Bach grew up in a world that believed in myth, and I don't mean by that false stories. Mm-hmm. I mean by that they had a kind of mythopoeic worldview. They believed in the kind of symbolic explanations of the world. And they came up against a movement that basically completely disavowed that thousand-year-old way of seeing. And for Bach, it had very practical consequences and affected really all of his working life.
I'm struck by how you, the man of the 21st century, ultimately seemed to kind of come down with Bach, who was considered old Bach then by Frederick the Great, and his music more or less disappeared for the better part of a century. He came down from a family of musicians, a century of music behind him already in the Bach clan.
I forget the number, but there were lots of Bachs before him and several after him.
And his son, at the time of this encounter, 1747, was actually working for Frederick the Great as his harpsichordist in his court.
Right, and Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, CPE Bach, as he's come to be known, was right in the middle of this conflict because he had his father, who was kind of overpowering as a musical genius and influence, and then he had Frederick, who was another kind of father, although he was much younger than he was, 35 to Bach, 62. So Carl was in an exquisitely painful position.
When Frederick called for his father to come to the court. Now, introduce us to Frederick the Great. He was such a figure at that time. Interestingly, Bach now towers much larger in the minds of most people. Frederick the Great had a rough childhood, but he grew up to be extraordinarily powerful. Introduce us.
He was a very astute warrior. He began his reign by accessing all of Silesia, which was a big portion of Austria at the time. He was a genius at military matters and strategy and in international politics. He was a very, very serious antagonist to France and Austria, which were the big powers of Europe at that point. And Prussia became a first-rank power because of Frederick. But he was also a flautist and a self-styled Enlightenment figure. Voltaire called him the philosopher king that they all hoped for. And at the beginning of his reign, had huge hopes that Frederick would be the kind of beacon of Enlightenment among powers in Europe.
Of course, Voltaire also noted that he was a dictator of the First Order, that when Frederick said you were his friend, he meant you were his slave.
Right.
When he said, my dear friend, it means, Voltaire said, you mean less than nothing to me, and come to dinner means I feel like making fun of you tonight. He'd been raised by a father who was brutally dismissive of his inclinations.
Yeah, his father was crazy, to put it briefly. He beat him. He beat Frederick when he was a boy, and he beat Frederick when he was a man. And when Frederick tried to get away from him, because the beatings were not only humiliating but dangerous, his father imprisoned him for what he called desertion, and then forced one of his co-conspirators, forced Frederick to watch as one of his co-conspirators was executed in front of his prison cell window.
Beheaded, I believe.
Yes, he was beheaded. And after that, Frederick was as you and I probably would be, a different person. I mean, he kept from his father all of his feelings at that point and learned to keep them from everyone, which made him a very, very agile, if deceitful, diplomat in the world of Europe then, which was a huge asset.
Voltaire loved Frederick the Great. Frederick the Great loved France, the kind of home of the Enlightenment. Describe for us how Frederick the Great embodied the Enlightenment.
Well, he was a student of all the Greek and Roman classics. He wrote poetry. He subsidized experiments of all sorts. He was a great patron of writers, scientists, artists. He wrote, I think, 200 works of his own for flute and orchestra. He was a real, what you'd say, Renaissance man if he weren't the Enlightenment. But he also was an enlightened leader in domestic terms. He reduced censorship. He introduced the first code of law in Prussia. He built homes for orphans and widows. He was a very enlightened leader domestically. It was in his military activities that he set the stage for a lot of bloodshed over centuries that followed.
He liked the kind of powdered curly wigs of France and the silks, and you write, was at least probably bisexual. His father had hated all that. He embraced it. And then he turned to his harpsichordist, Carl Bach, CPE Bach, and more than once said, I want to meet your father. Why did he want that, James Gaines? You write that he despised Johann Sebastian Bach's music. He said it smells of the church. He said his chorales were specifically dumb stuff. Why did he want to meet Bach?
Well, Frederick was, as many sadistic people are, a great player of practical jokes. And part of the reason that he and Voltaire had such an explosive relationship was that he would make fun of people, and he made fun of Voltaire, and he wanted to make fun of old Bach, because old Bach was the giant of the late Baroque, which was everything that Frederick despised. It was everything actually that his father stood for. And I think that was a big part of his motivation in wanting to humiliate Bach. The fact that Bach stood for everything for disbelieving which he was beaten all his childhood. And beside that, there was a kind of piquant joy in bettering the master of improvisation and counterpoint in his own game.
What do you think old Bach was thinking as he trundled toward Frederick on that those days in 1747?
Well, he knew that Frederick had not been a kind employer to his son, and that he had just spent 2 days rattling around in a coach at the age of 62. It was an overnight coach in which it was impossible to sleep. And when Frederick summoned him immediately to the palace once he heard that he was at the town gate, Bach hadn't slept in 2 days. He was old. He was tired. He didn't want to go. But it was a summons from a king, and you can't gainsay that.
So, and out of that came this epic encounter. James Gaines in Paris. We have to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll look at exactly what was set up between Frederick the Great and Bach. James R. Gaines joins us from Paris tonight. His new book is Evening in the Palace of Reason, the worlds of belief, the worlds of reason colliding. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the world of belief, the world of reason, and the long-ago meeting of the two that still lights up our world today. My guest tonight is James R. Gaines. He joins me tonight from Paris. His new book is Evening in the Palace of Reason, Bach Meets Frederick the Great in the Age of Enlightenment. Of course, that's Bach's Brandenburg Concerto behind us, the fifth Brandenburg behind us. James Gaines, you've been bringing us up to the point of this encounter that you describe in 1747, when Bach, the man of belief, of faith, who's written some of the greatest music in the history of Western civilization, is seen suddenly in the age of Frederick the Great as old and musty, and he's asked to the court. And tell us about the detail of what Frederick puts before him.
Well, Frederick had a great bunch of musicians, the best musicians in Europe at the time, composers and performers. And they had all gathered for the evening concert when Frederick found out that Bach had arrived at the town gate. So he summons Bach and presents him with a figure of 21 notes. Bach was playing his forte pianos, which is the kind of antecedent to the modern piano. And at one of the stops that they made, Frederick sat down and played a theme of 21 notes and asked Bach if he would improvise on it.
Bach was famous for his improvisations.
He was famous for improvisation, and he was famous for improvising fugues. But this particular group of 21 notes was as resistant to counterpoint as any theme ever devised. And the speculation is it can never be known, that the only person in Frederick's court who could have devised such a theme was Bach's son, Carl, because only he could have known enough counterpoint to stump his father. But in whoever wrote it, Frederick gave it to Bach absolutely sure that Bach could never do anything with it.
Because it was just too resistant in its structure to the kind of improvisation that Bach would do.
Yes, it's exceedingly chromatic. There's a passage of half notes, a descending passage of half notes in the middle of it that, just by the nature of fugue, is just about, it's impossible.
James Gaines, stand by. Let's listen to what Frederick the Great, in that meeting in 1747, tapped out on the pianoforte as a challenge to Johann Sebastian Bach. Here's that 21-note theme.
there it is. The King's 21-note theme, a kind of sadistic chromatic challenge to old Bach. This is the moment where presumably he was thinking, I will have bested the representative of the old world.
Absolutely. I'm sure he felt that. And I would not doubt that the composers in the room would have thought the same thing. As every half note succeeded upon the last, they would have been thinking, oh, my God, what could he possibly do with that as a fugue theme?
So here, the monarch of the Enlightenment hands this to the great composer of the Age of Faith, surrounded by the court, presumably. They have all the courtiers in attendance?
Yep, absolutely.
And Bach sits down and proceeds to improvise, and we have that improvisation. Let's hear some of it now. This improvised by Johann Sebastian Bach. James Gaines will talk about how Frederick upped the ante. But just for a moment, sit with us on this improvisation. How, for all his genius, how was Bach able to do this? What are the ingredients of his life, his training, his view of the world that enabled that kind of improvisation?
He was the hardest working composer that has ever lived, for one thing. For another, he was obviously a genius. And it's beyond me to get into what that's about. But he deployed his genius beautifully and was very, very rigorous about learning everything about every style of music in his time, not only counterpoint, but also the most wonderful melodic devices of Italy and France. And he himself said it was hard work. I think it's got to be more than that. It's got to be something innate, and as the descendant of a family of musicians, obviously it ran in the family, as they say.
There was a great legacy being played out here as well. You write how the kind of formulas for putting this kind of music together were handed down in almost a brotherhood of composers.
Yeah, it was likened at the time to alchemy, whose codes were also passed down in a very secretive way. Your teacher would say, "Well, you can copy one page of this now," and often you'd have to pay him for the right. And Bach studied with some great people. And also, when he went to a school in Lüneburg, he just sat in the library for hours and hours and hours and practiced for hours and hours and hours. And he never gave up the rigor of the work ethic that he brought to his student years.
But Frederick the great king of the Age of Enlightenment, was not about to be bested by old Bach, and he turned around with another challenge after this incredible improvisation. What was that, James Gaines?
Yeah, well, as everybody was just astonished that Bach had managed to bring this off, in the press report it says people were seized with astonishment.
The press report, this is a kind of press release put out by Frederick's people.
Yes, it was, actually. It was a palace press release. So Frederick then, but this part was not in the press release. Mm-hmm. Frederick then said, "Look, what about a six-part fugue?"
A six-part?
And I don't know in what world that could be a polite question.
Had Bach ever written a six-part fugue?
Bach had never written a six-part fugue, no. And Frederick was enough of a musician to know how ridiculous the request was and how amazing it was that Bach had even managed to do the three-part fugue. And so Bach, you know, as fatigued as he was, he had to be furious at having been put to that put into the position of having to defer this challenge, because he'd never, ever been in a similar position in his life.
That is, he had to concede. He could not improvise a six-part fugue, but he didn't drop the challenge.
No, he didn't. He said, I'll have to get back to you on that. And
Your Highness.
When I get back home to Leipzig, I'll work it out and send it to you. And he played a six-part fugue that on a very simple theme, but he must have been furious as he did it.
But he went home, he sat down, and he did what the king surely thought was the impossible. He came back with what was called a musical offering, an offering to the king. And in that offering, you say, you write, James Gaines, that he really put it in the face of this king, perhaps like no monarch has ever been confronted before with a rebuke to not only a challenge, but an entire view of the world.
Yeah, he sent Frederick back a 16-part, a 16-movement work based on the royal theme. And included in the work, especially notably, were a flute sonata that Frederick was probably not capable of playing, and 10 canons, the most rigorous form of counterpoint, a form that Bach had always used to connote the law. And he gave Frederick exactly 10 of them. And the number 10 in Bach's work almost always refers to the Ten Commandments. And when it's 10 canons, it definitely refers to the Ten Commandments. And nothing could smell more like the church to Frederick than 10 canons. Because he would have known what it meant in Bach's work, and there were certainly enough people around who knew to tell him.
You savor this musical offering and all that meant in this kind of clash of ages. You say that Bach's musical offering leaves us, among other things, a compelling case for the following proposition, that a world without a sense of the transcendent and mysterious, a universe ultimately discoverable through reason alone, can only be a barren place, and that the music sounding forth from such a world might be very pretty, but it can never be beautiful. Is there evidence that Frederick took all that on board?
Well, no. I think that's the message to us. I don't think Frederick paid any attention, frankly. There's no evidence that Frederick ever played the musical offering. It might have just made him angry when he got it, because there was also a beautiful 6-part fugue based on the royal theme. And he gave it away. It finally turned up in the library of one of his sisters, who was a fan of Bach and collected his music. So no, I don't think Frederick would have taken it in. I think when Bach left Potsdam, Frederick would have forgotten about him. He was a toy that Frederick threw away.
And Frederick went on to live with his title, the Great, for many years, while Bach's music drifted into obscurity, then came back as Frederick ultimately drifted into relative obscurity to stand as one of the great giants of Western civilization, Johann Sebastian Bach. James Gaines, if you permit me, I'd like to expand our circle of conversation a little bit here. We have joining us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Tony LaVopa. He's professor of history at North Carolina State University, co-editor of Enthusiasm and Enlightenment in Europe, 1650 to 1850. Tony LaVopa, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. I'm very glad to be here.
You've been patiently listening along to the story of this encounter in 1747 and all the music that went with it. You spent a lot of time looking at the Enlightenment and all that was unfolding here. You see how James R. Gaines is framing this as a kind of tipping point between two great eras, these two men and their enthusiasms and their little clash here representing that. How does it resonate for you, Tony LaVopa?
Oh, I find it fascinating. I teach this encounter, actually, in my course in German history, but I haven't really considered the larger meaning that James has given to it, and much of it makes a great deal of sense to me. It is one of those moments that historians love because they can see larger trends and meanings and changes radiating out from it. So,
and give us your interpretation of that meeting, that moment. When you speak to your classes about it, what were the great forces or worldviews that were meeting there?
Well, I think I would I'd have to say that I interpret it a little bit differently from James. Mm-hmm. In this sense, certainly I fully agree with him that you have here a confrontation of religious belief and reason. But whether that can be characterized as a confrontation between religious belief and the Enlightenment, I would be, I think, a little bit more cautious about. The reason being that... Yeah, sorry.
Open that up for us. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, you know, in the last several decades, historians studying the Enlightenment have come to realize that much of the Enlightenment, particularly in Protestant countries, was an attempt to obviously to purify religion and eliminate what people saw as superstitions and magical beliefs of one kind or another, but at the same time to find a way of find a new foundation for some core of genuine religious belief or belief in the transcendent. Again, this was particularly true in Protestant countries like Germany, as opposed to France, where Voltaire's motto was "Éclater l'infâme," crush the infamous, which meant crush the entire Christian church.
But in Germany, the empiricist efforts were often put toward proving the existence of God.
Yes, or at least the philosophical efforts. That is to say, the attempt. There's an attempt in Germany, a long-standing attempt that culminates in Kant, to clear away the clutter, but at the same time to preserve the core. One of the ironies, I think, of this story, and I don't know if James would agree with me or not, is that in a sense what happened here is that Frederick, on issues of religion, actually represented the radical wing of the Enlightenment. But then in succeeding
in his rejection of religion?
Particularly, yes, in his total rejection of religion, yes. But that became, in later generations, a kind of stereotype notion of what the Enlightenment as a whole had been. But I think we know now that that really was not the case. But he certainly represented one trend, ironically, much more a trend much more prominent in France than it was in his own country, in Germany. But that's not surprising, because Frederick's Enlightenment was the French Enlightenment. That's the Enlightenment he had been educated in. He spoke French.
Didn't even read and write German.
No, he didn't read and write German, and he had said several times quite bluntly that he didn't think German was capable of being a literary language. So he represents, in a sense, an extreme preference for French culture. I think that's one thing that we might want to bring into the story, if I may. It's hard for us, I think, now to imagine how dominated Europe was in the 18th century by French culture, which meant essentially by Enlightenment, French Enlightenment culture, the culture of Voltaire and other Enlightenment authors. But the Germans were, in that sense, almost a kind of cultural colony of the French. The language of German aristocratic life, the language the aristocracy spoke among themselves, was French.
So not a colony in Johann Sebastian Bach's house, but
not
in Frederick's court.
No, there's still a very distinctly German Lutheran world out there, but above all in the world of the aristocracy and in the world of the courts, the preference was clearly for French, and this did produce a great deal of frustration among authors, and I think some musicians who aspired to build a culture that had indigenous roots. I'm not sure Bach himself cared much about that. Bach was simply a Lutheran. He was a German Lutheran,
right,
and in
right.
the eyes of Frederick, I'm sure, quite provincial.
Of course, later, later, James Gaines, you write, of course, Germans re-embraced Bach as the very soul of Germanness, and Bach embraced for his Germanness, Frederick embraced as the kind of as the great hero whose grave Hitler would bow at.
Yeah, that was obviously a lot later, and there was a lot of. Sort of retrospective rewriting of history involved in that. Frederick would not have considered himself a Teutonic hero in any circumstances. He would have laughed at the idea.
We're going to come back in just a moment and look at how all of this shines a light and a sound forward onto our lives and controversies today. We're joined tonight by James R. Gaines, author of the new book, Evening in the Palace of Reason, joins us from Paris, and from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Tony Vopa. He's professor of history at North Carolina State University. We're looking at the world of belief and the world of reason meeting in a long-ago rendezvous there in Potsdam, what is now Germany. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll go out listening to more of Bach's six-part fugue offered in response to Frederick the Great. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking tonight about the world of belief, the world of reason, and the long-ago meeting of the two that still lights up our world today. Our guest tonight, James R. Gaines, joins us from Paris this evening. He's author of the new book, Evening in the Palace of Reason, Bach Meets Frederick the Great in the Age of Enlightenment. And from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Tony Lavopa is with us, professor of history at North Carolina State University, co-editor of Enthusiasm and Enlightenment in Europe, 1650 to 1850. You'll hear behind me right now, of course, Bach's St. Matthew's Passion, another one of his great masterworks, and you can hear devout bow to all divine there in that tremendous work. James Gaines, you entitle your book Evening in the Palace of Reason. I think that many people in the 20th century, 21st century looking back, would see that as more the dawn of the era of reason that, at least for most of the 20th century, we saw ourselves as the torchbearers for.
Yes, I think that's true. It's a bit of a play on the fact that it wasn't evening and that Frederick's palace was the palace of reason. It really was more of a confrontation between faith and reason than it was between faith and the Enlightenment. This was the early Enlightenment, and it developed into more than it was then, certainly. And this was in its extreme optimism and before some discouragement set in.
You say that Frederick is someone that we would recognize very well as modern people. You draw the contrast with Bach, a stranger to us, a refugee from God's time, you say, but how is it that we'd recognize Frederick today?
I think that Frederick lived in, as Peter Gay put it, a disenchanted world. The world we live in is a disenchanted world.
That is separated from enchantment.
Yes, exactly. With the exception of people who are very devout, or, you know, maybe not so devout, but regular church-going people, who I think that non-churchgoers have a very difficult time claiming the spirituality that is just natural part of life. One of the things that the Enlightenment did, it created a space between secular life and sacred life. Mm-hmm. Before the Enlightenment, there really was no such space. It was all, to put it very baldly, the world was a battleground between God and Satan. And there was no place to go where that was not the case. After the Enlightenment, there became a secular round and a religious realm. You know, you could say that the court of Louis XIV wasn't terribly sacred. This is not a generalization that holds, like most generalizations, but to a great extent, that was true. And that schism has gotten wider, or chasm has gotten wider as time has gone on. I mean, there are lots of people for whom religion is a matter, or spirituality, I should say, not so much religion, is a matter of a building in a day of the week. As I say in the book, it's something you do on Sundays, you know, or Friday nights. It's not part of weekday life for non-churchgoers. And I guess it's to them that I'm writing more than it is to, you know, people who follow organized religion.
Because you're ultimately beguiled here deeply by Bach's, the tapestry of faith that he lives and composes in. Tony Lavopa, let me turn to you here because
yes. You
know, this has been politically and culturally a great theme of recent years. Some people saying we're turning away from the great age of reason. We're turning our backs on the Enlightenment in the sort of red-blue debates that played out politically in America last year and in the rise of evangelicals. And evangelicals saying, and hallelujah, it's about time we had more faith, more awareness of the kind of mystic envelope of the divine here. As a scholar of this time, how do you see the drama playing out today?
Well, it's interesting. I guess I would think about it in terms of the association that's often made between religious belief and intolerance that is for other religious beliefs. And one of the most notable things about Frederick was that he introduced a very large measure of religious tolerance in Prussia. The qualified exception was Jews, but among Christian sects and among non-believers, he left things quite open and free. But in fact, it's not clear at this point, looking back, that one can call this tolerance in a sense that we would welcome. It's a kind of even-handed contempt for all religious belief, all of its silly superstition. It's a kind of intolerant tolerance. And this is a feature of the Enlightenment. It's not true of all Enlightenment thinkers, but certainly there was some tendency for reason in its claim to be tolerant to actually be intolerant in the sense of simply not taking seriously the emotional or the spiritual meaning of religion.
Nevertheless, it had some pretty glorious moments. I want to just get a flavor of that in here. Of course, later along came the great composer of later Enlightenment, Mozart. Just a sense of the passion for human life. Let's hear it here, just a touch in his Jupiter Symphony. James Gaines, I have to say, as much as I love Bach, when Mozart comes along, I feel myself rising to it and saying, yes, I'm for the Enlightenment. Does that make me a godless creature of Frederick School?
No, hardly. But I would make the point, as I did in the book, and, you know, why not get those letters coming in, Tom, you know? I think that Mozart... if you spend a lot of time listening to Bach, it feels like there's something missing. It feels like, I mean, as sublime and lovely as his work can be.
He never blows the roof off, for me.
Not quite, no.
So your sympathies at the end of the day, James Gaines, come down with old Bach. You say not with Frederick, you say we know too well his kind of, his mask and his loneliness, and you associate them with the Enlightenment, and you throw your hand in with the man of faith. Did that surprise you?
Not really, since I've been a fan of Bach my whole life. But I spent most of my life in corporate life, at Time Incorporated. And when you're in the thick of things, as I was then, there's a certain unconsciousness and a certain lack of feeling that comes with responsibilities to lots of people and, and busyness and
the hurly-burly.
The hurly-burly, exactly. And I recognized in myself some of the things that I was seeing in Frederick. This, as I say in the book, that sense that you're being very self-effacing and skeptical about things as you run toward the glamour of great deeds. And there was something about Bach that speaks above all that. And I do relate to that.
Tony LaVopa, where do you end up? With Bach or Mozart? With Age of Faith, Age of Reason? Can we not ultimately have it all?
I mean, if I have to make a choice between Bach and Mozart, I think I would probably go with Bach. And there's a certain paradox to that which is, I guess, the paradox of what we've been talking about, and that is that Bach was an extraordinarily, by the standards of Frederick the Great, the cosmopolitan standards of Frederick the Great, Bach was an extremely provincial man. And yet his music expressed a kind of universality of feeling and experience that Frederick's commitment to reason could not.
Well, the old-time religion, the old-time universality, getting the thumbs up from our guest tonight. We're out of time with that, but it's been a fascinating conversation. Tony LaVopa at North Carolina State, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
And James R. Gaines, what a wonderful book, a wonderful history. Thanks so much for the inspiration to write it and for delivering it. It's just a terrific book, Evening in the Palace of Reason. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
If people have the ability to repay some of their debt, shouldn't they have to repay some of their debt? It seems to me to be fair to those people who do pay their debt.
I'm just out here to confirm that we do have four individuals at the Fulton County Courthouse, 136 building, who were shot this morning.
They're playing Hezbollah songs, shouting Allahu Akbar. They have banners hanging up saying, thank you, Syria, no to foreign interference. But everyone is also carrying Lebanese flags. They're showing that it's a national movement, but they do appreciate Syria being here.
I have some information about what took place at the checkpoint.
Elaborate, is what information you have that maybe we don't have?
No, I prefer just to leave that to the investigating officer to put all this thing in perspective for you.
We were quite delighted by the end of the case. President Clinton's lung was very healthy, pink appearing, and looked excellent, and we expect full functional recovery of that lung.
He tripped this morning and he fell in the early morning hours while he was getting dressed. His back is in terrible pain. He was in terrible discomfort during the entire trial proceedings.
To each of you, courage. For the CBS Evening News, Dan Rather reporting. Good night.
And there is a week. The Senate passes legislation that will make it more difficult for consumers to wipe out debt through bankruptcy. A shooting at an Atlanta courthouse leaves a judge, court reporter, and deputy dead. Lebanon's ousted Prime Minister Omar Karami returns to the job after massive pro-Syria demonstrations. General George Casey is tight-lipped about what led to the shooting of an Italian journalist by U.S. forces in Iraq. It was a particularly violent week in Iraq. Among the bloody events, a suicide bomber killed 40 at a funeral in Mosul, and 30 bullet-ridden bodies are found in a mass grave near the Syrian border. Former President Clinton's second surgery in 6 months is called successful. Michael Jackson narrowly avoids imprisonment after he shows up more than an hour late for his trial, complaining of back pain. And Dan Rather signs off for the final time as anchor of the CBS Evening News after 24 years. Jack Beatty, there we are. Bankruptcy is going to be tougher. And we saw on Capitol Hill this week there will be no hike in the minimum wage. Thank you.
Yes, that's how the week began. All Democrats voted for a hike. Most Republicans, nearly all Republicans, voted against it. 1968 was the last year when a family of three could earn the minimum wage and be above the poverty line. 1968.
So stack that up against the other side. If you're counting on plastic to get through and things go wrong, it's going to be a lot tougher on the bankruptcy side.
It's not going to work. And, you know, some of the amendments that the Democrats tried to get into that bill, they wanted an exemption for medical bankruptcies, which we know constitute half of bankruptcies. Mm. No exemption. They wanted an exemption for National Guard people serving in Iraq whose businesses might collapse while they're there. No exemption. They wanted an exemption for wounded veterans of Iraq whose affairs might go awry while they're there. No exemption.
Jack, how do you figure that? Because these days, Americans know things can go wrong. You can lose a job, you can get sick, and you can be in trouble. Don't the congressmen fear some voter concern about that?
The answer is no. It was town meeting week up here in Vermont and New Hampshire, direct democracy. And if you think of government, you could have a continuum. On one side, there'd be the Vermont town meeting. In the middle, representative government, where we vote for people who go and represent us.
At a distance.
The majority will. And then to the right side, you get something called oligarchy. Whoops. Government by the few and for the few. And that and the bankruptcy bill is exhibit A for oligarchy. Not 100 people in this country who aren't connected with the credit card or banking industry wanted this bill. And yet it is law, and 18 Democratic senators voted for it.
Among them, Joe Biden, of course, and the credit card industry is based in his home state of Delaware.
It sure is, and I watched the vote, and one of the last people to vote, and he just kind of crept in, and he did it fast, and then retreated was Harry Reid from Nevada. He voted for it, and of course, you know, He's one of the top 20 people in the Senate in campaign contributions from the bank, the credit card industry. So there it is, you see. The 20 million people who would benefit by a minimum wage increase, they don't bribe the politicians through these PACs. The credit card industry does. They get what they want.
Jack, my friend, do not go bankrupt. What else is on your list this week?
Well, speaking of going bankrupt, January saw the second largest trade deficit in history, $58.7 billion. And it was also the week when the Japanese prime minister let drop this sentence: I think it's necessary to have diversity, meaning Japan wants to look at other places to put the huge amount of American dollars that it's receiving from selling its goods here. This is really bad. I mean, last year, even in advanced electronics, which is, you know, people say that's the deus ex machina, mm-hmm. that's the American future.
The high rung we'll stand on. Mm-hmm.
$37 billion trade deficit last year in that.
And, of course, that's all floated by those investment funds that have come in from Japan, China, other big exporting countries.
That's right. And, of course, if they decide to put their money someplace else, we're going to have to finance our own deficits and our own economy. And that gets right back to the budget deficit. President Bush this week said, we're fixing the deficit in Alabama. Yet the CBO, it's a neutral organization.
Congressional Budget Office, yep.
That's right. Says that Bush's budget, far from fixing the deficit, would increase it. $1.6 trillion over the next decade. Bush says we're fixing the deficit. I don't know how you compare those two. You make those things coincide, and that's without privatizing Social Security.
Jack, I don't mean to pile on here, but I do have to look over our shoulder. A week or 10 days ago, we had folks on celebrating the March of Democracy in the Middle East and saying, was President Bush right here after all? He may be, but it's not going to be an easy path. We heard just now the pro-Syrian Prime Minister of Lebanon back in office after massive pro-Syrian demonstrations there, after the anti-Syrian demonstrations the week before. Democracy in the Middle East could be a surprising and messy business for the U.S.
Oh, it sure could. And you know, we have no control over any of these dynamics. I mean, perhaps we broke the China and the pieces are sort of, sometimes they look like they're going to fall in the shape of democracy, sometimes into anarchy. But we have no shape or control over what's happening there.
Well, we will watch with riveted interest. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Jim Moses, Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.